just look for the 1, 2, 3 and see, I've screwed you up there by doing the 1, 2, 3 ahead of, you know, you're going to have to think about whether it's me doing 1, 2, 3 or you doing 1, 2, 3.
No, I press it on you. I just started recording. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So I was the 1, 2, 3.
I just hit record when you told me.
Wow.
Yeah.
What an honor.
So we had the pleasure of talking to Ged and David on Iterate, and they told us about how they designed Twitterific 5, or I guess how David sort of just started drawing it and then forced you guys to develop it. Is that a fair statement?
That's pretty much how it went down, yeah. But David was smart about how he told us to develop it. He made an awesome little prototype, and we all... Yeah, it was enough to tap around and see kind of what it looked like and, you know, how it was going to feel and some of the interactions. And it was like...
He seduced you. He seduced you entirely.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I don't know. Sean could comment about his feelings. Mine was just like, oh my God. Now it's not a great time to be building a Twitter client, but we need to build this.
Yeah, David showed me a little bit before he showed you, and so I was in on it a little bit earlier too. But it was really nice to be able to tap on the he had like a prototyping, some kind of website that did like prototyping, so you could tap hot areas and it would flip to a different image. So it really felt real.
Yeah, a lot of people have asked me that the name of the app is Prototypes, and it basically takes a bunch of PNG files and links them up with, you know, tap areas, and then puts the result out on a website where you can access it with a pin code. So David basically gave us the link to that website and the pin code, and we had a meeting, and everybody's going, that makes sense. Yeah. That's good. That's a lot better than the current version, isn't it?
Was it a tough sell at all, or like were you... Did you think
strategically, it was a tough sell.
Yeah.
Right? We knew that the app just looked great and had some really great and innovative, you know, actions and interactions in it. But like I said, it's beginning of the year. You know, that was just Twitter had started making noises about limiting third-party development, and we didn't know at all what that meant. We've had a long relationship with Twitter, and it's been a good relationship, but it was obviously starting to change. So, yeah, that was the hardest part, really, about before we started the project, to decide, you know, was it a good thing to do. And it was a total risky decision. You know, it could have easily have played out that Twitter says, well, you know, we're not allowing any more third-party development. We're done. Right?
So what they did do, though, is limit your user tokens. So I think it's 100,000 for a new app, or double what you had when the policy went into effect. And just in my mind, it made it look like people would be lining up for user tokens or trying to sneak them across the border or something.
Yeah. We're pretty lucky in that we've got plenty of user tokens. And I know I've talked with Paul Haddad, and they're, you know, guys at Tapbots and, you know, Tweetbots in the same situation. You know, they've got plenty for the foreseeable future. In fact, we both, you know, after they announced that, we both posted things on our website saying, you know, we got plenty of tokens. Don't worry. You know, we're fine for now.
Yes.
So yeah, it is a limited resource though, right? It's like, you know, there's only so many copies of Twitterific or Tweetbot that can be sold now. You know, there's a finite number.
Did the uncertainty sort of limit the scope that you had planned for the initial release?
Yeah.
Because you started planning this before you even know what the particular restrictions were going to be.
Yep. Early on, it was pretty clear that we had to do as little as possible, right? There's two reasons for doing that. It's not only just, you know, Twitter and the uncertainty. It's also a good idea, you know, for any developers that are out here listening to this, get your first version out that's the least amount you can do and make it really great. That's a better strategy than releasing something that's got a bazillion features that are kind of 50 to 80% done, right? And, you know, half-assed work
right.
that does a lot of things. I mean, it's because you don't know, right? It's like we don't know mm-hmm. if people really need muting functions in a Twitter client. I mean, do the people who use Twitterific really desperately need muting?
So do you think that you guys would have felt more compelled to add a bunch of features had Twitter not been making noises about becoming more restrictive? Like, did they give you a limitation where you said, well, we're not going to invest too much time in this because we potentially run against a wall, that ended up sort of helping you refine the focus of your product?
That's a good question. We believe in having focused products, you know, products that have our opinions in them, right? And mm-hmm. from a visual standpoint, it was very obvious that this prototype that David did, his simplicity was the key, right? It was just, it looked simple. But at the same time, it had the right. ability to access things in a logical way. So, I mean, that was decided very early on, right? And that kind of limits your scope there, saying that, you know, we're going to keep things simple mm-hmm. to start with. I think when Twitter came out with the new rules and regulations, it was like, okay, I'm glad we limited our scope. You know, it's sort of validation of what we were already doing. And there was, to be honest, there was more urgency to get the thing out, to get the product released, because the old version, which was free, was using up user tokens. Right from the day that they announced that the 1.1 release would be out, you know, people were downloading the free version and using up a user token. So it's like, oh god.
So that must have been an interesting day for you, because you had started on Twitterific 5 before you knew what particular restrictions were going to be in place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Then when they announce what the restrictions actually are, it's kind of good news, kind of bad news. There's kind of a lot of weird stuff in terms of how they sort of mandate that tweets must be laid out in a certain way.
Yeah. I don't know if David and Ged talked about that on the Iterate podcast, but there was some redesign involved there. Mm-hmm. We had to, conform to their display requirements. Now, the thing that was really odd for us is then that Twitter comes out and releases a new version of its own app, which doesn't follow the display requirements. So, what's going on there?
Yeah. Well, their left hand doesn't know what their mutant third hand is doing, pretty much.
Yeah. We rely on Twitter's infrastructure. Always have. And I recognize that. I mean, it's not an easy thing to make something on the scale that Twitter has made.
Right. Well, we've seen them grow, and it's, you know, it's obviously not easy. Yeah.
We're standing on the shoulders of giants kind of thing. So for, you know, us to complain about all these things and say, you know, that they're providing an API that we take advantage of. Mm-hmm. And we make money off of a product that we sell that uses that API. It's pretty simple formula. So they get to call the shots. Mm-hmm. They really do.
I do like, so we've had Lauren and Paul Haddad mm-hmm. on, just because it's the all Twitter client show.
Oh, okay.
And they both have the same sort of thoughts on that as you do, in that, you know, Twitter's providing the pipes, and clearly there needs to be some sort of quid pro quo there. I think the issue is mostly that the sort of the communication in the black box of it is off-putting.
In fact, that was the thing earlier this year that was most concerning to us, is that the communications weren't. I mean, we kind of got a feeling from some things we saw on post to their Google group, and then there was this weird kind of post saying that changes are going to come, and then it's like once the changes, they announce them, it was like, yeah, well, that seems okay for, you know, for us, you know, maybe for some other smaller Twitter clients, you know, it killed them. I know a couple of developers who just, you know, basically shut down their product because they didn't have enough user tokens. You know, in addition to them announcing the user tokens limit, they also introduced the API 1.1, which is great. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of the problems that we had with 1.0 have been fixed pretty awesomely in 1.1. You know, for example, search results return real tweet objects, not this kind of Frankenstein tweet object. You know, just recently they improved how you retrieve friends and followers, so it's a lot faster in the app. So they're making big improvements in 1.1. And that kind of got lost in all of the, you know, oh yeah, Twitter's killing third-party developers, you know, blah, 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 you know, the stink. So, I mean, I would bet, I don't know this for a fact, but I bet there are two factions within Twitter, the company, the business people who see advertising revenue and that path forward, and the engineers, the technical people who see or would like to see Twitter as a, you know, more of a communication medium, you know, and make money more like a traditional, you know, communications company, you know, by charging people to use the pipe rather than, you know, here's a free pipe with stuff you want and ads.
Right. So maybe we'll see the pendulum swing back the other way if there's enough of a, you know, if it goes too far.
No, I think it's already swung too far. I mean, they've made their choice, right? It would be hard for them to back out right now. Really?
Yeah, it's not so much, I mean, back out. It's more that in the future, maybe they'll stop being quite so aggressive in terms of pushing stuff. Maybe. I don't know. I'm trying to be hopeful here.
Well, no, again, it's also their user base is not us anymore. It's the people who hashtag Survivor and American Idol, and they're just fine with the new Twitter.
Yeah.
I kind of see them going the route of AOL Instant Messenger. You know, it was like the only game in town for a long time after everyone moved off to ICQ.
Right, right.
But because it was closed down and they never really opened it up, it just, you know, faded away. I think that could happen to Twitter.
That'd be interesting. It's still used all the time, though. They just don't make any. See, IM's a little bit weird because it's really hard to make money on that.
Yeah, I think it might be hard on Twitter, too.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, at least have a website to show you an ad or stick something in your face. Although IRC would be pretty funny if every now and then just like some Max Headroom guy popped up and like tried to pitch you something.
Yeah, the thing that's interesting is that there's a larger portion of the internet population that is realizing that there are costs involved with free apps, right? That the whole thing with Instagram recently, you know, their new terms and conditions and, you know, Twitter.
That got a lot more traction broadly than I expected it to. There was like famous people pissed off about that.
And, you know, of course, Instagram and Facebook and these companies, you know, they push as far as they can and they back off a little to appease people. That's their MO.
But they never back off quite as far as they were originally. They push forward, back off a little bit, and
right,
like gas prices.
It's literally the two steps forward, one step back. You know, they still moved a step forward.
And we fall for it every time. I mean, it's the free as in Google pitch, and no matter how often it happens, I mean, we saw terms of service with Facebook, with Google, and yet we keep gravitating to these services.
Well, it's that old, it's easier to, or better to ask forgiveness and permission. Because I think, you know, we see Apple doing the same thing, not in the same vein, but in terms of, you know, they'll lock down the Mac App Store sandboxing rules and then slowly start to open them up as they realize it, like, okay, well, that was, you know, one bridge too far. Same thing with the App Store and Same thing, you know, even the iPhone initially was like, no, you can't run anything on it.
Developers do that too, right? You know, I'm going to scrape the contacts database and upload it to my website.
Right.
Yeah. No problem. Yeah, I can do that.
Tries to overreach. And, yeah.
Oh, Apple doesn't like that. Well, maybe we better back off and, you know, at least prompt people that we're going to do it.
And one of the interesting things that I don't think everyone was aware of is that it's per platform for the tokens, right? So if you were to make a Twitterific version for another platform, you would be essentially a new app.
Yeah, well, we already have a Mac client, so we've got a bunch of user tokens there.
A Mac client, you've got the oldest.
Yeah, the original.
Yeah,
classic.
That is. Yeah, it's Twitter. That is Twitter.
But you know, it needs an update. We know it needs an update. You know, Sean has written Chameleon, so you know it's pretty obvious that that's how we would move forward. But
yeah,
it was a lot of work to get the current version out, and there's the current version for iOS, and there's still a bunch of stuff that we want to do for iOS.
Right.
You know, we've said that. You know, there are things like muting and push notifications and things like that that a lot of people have asked for. And we kind of knew that people were going to ask for these, but it's just, again, you know, you got to get out in front of people to see if it's really something people want or not.
Muting seems a little bit weird to me. I don't know.
Yeah,
I've never used it. So.
It's a lightweight unfollow. It's like when you don't really want to unfollow somebody, but, you know.
Like your boss or your sister-in-law.
Or Louis Mantilla.
I was just going to say, it's the Mantilla switch.
Basically, that's it. That's how any of us would use it. You know, it's like, oh, Louis's going off on user experience again.
Or, whatever it is. Just scroll through 3 pages of Louis tweets and just...
It does look like a way for Twitter to limit your brand. For example, if you're a Tweetbot or you're a Twitterific, you effectively can't go to Android, or you couldn't go if there's another hot platform that comes out after iOS. You would be stuck as a new app there with a very limited user base, and that ensures that Twitter gets to have the biggest brand in the business always.
That we've already seen that happen with Windows 8.
Yeah, those poor guys got I don't know them, but
I am very confident iOS is going to be around for the next 30 years,
right?
Like the Mac has been. I mean, Apple builds platforms for the long term. How long was System 7 a viable product? A long time. Well, okay.
It was around a long time. I'll give you that.
I shouldn't say viable is not the right word. How long was Apple selling it?
Exactly.
How long was it tenable?
God, yeah. In fact, have either of you or any of you... actually booted up Mac OS 8 or 7.5 anytime in the last year?
No,
you should.
Not recently.
Yeah, you should. I mean, it's wild. It's like, God, I ever used this and I thought it was good.
Do you miss anything from it?
I still miss the spatial finder.
You know,
Syracuse's big beef with his
windmill.
Yeah, I find myself having, for whatever reason, like a project build folder or something like that, at least 4 or 5 windows open over the course of a few days. Cause it just opens itself again. So, you know, it's like I'm in the finder or in a terminal window and I say, you know, open dot and boop, there's another one.
Yeah. I have the same thing. I have no idea that's what, like 11 years of OS 10, and I still don't really know how the Finder works.
Yeah.
Like I can never remember what keys to mash to actually open a folder. I just keep a bunch of windows open in column browser mode. And
I just spotlight everything now.
Yeah. I think that's the key right there, is that spotlight is how most people find stuff. In fact, I've listened to my wife give tech support to her mom. You know, go up to the upper right and click on the magnifying glass. Now, what was the name? It was about Republican National Party. Okay, try typing that in. Oh, there it is.
That's pretty good, though.
Right.
That's good.
Yeah. It's
because it kind of flattens your conceptual model. Like, is when you're digging around, I mean, not us because we deal with so many files.
Right. That,
but it's, you know, I'm sure when you're developing, you hit whatever it is, Command Shift O, and you type in the name of the class and you open it up. Right. You know what I mean? Like you know what you want. And if you can just quickly say what you want, then it's, you know, it's sometimes easier than rummaging around through a bunch of files.
I actually don't use Command Shift O very often. I just dig through the source list constantly.
Look at so spatial.
Yeah, exactly. And Sean and I have just over the course of working with them, I used to keep it organized by sort of functional area.
Mm-hmm.
And then Junior started organizing it alphabetically. And it's like, I first resisted that. It's like, oh God, I don't know if I, and then it's like, oh, wait a second. It's kind of a nice mix between that, you know what you want, and spatial, because you can just, you can scan it alphabetically or kind of know, okay. Yeah, I remember the window classes are down at the bottom because they're W's, right, or whatever.
It's not a bad idea.
So
I do that, and then I use that filter that shows by source control status.
Right.
So it effectively is like, this is what I'm working on.
Right.
The list is very tiny.
That is a good idea.
Yeah.
So I don't do that search either. I just click.
Okay, I'll try that.
Filtering by recent works pretty well, too. So it just keeps the, you know, recently modified files in the list.
Yeah, I don't mess with those buttons. I mean, they're so small. Like, I know what they do, but I very rarely go and, like, sort of mess with them very much.
Yeah. Well, Xcode's problem in my mind is that there's too many ways to do things.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, let's put every UI affordance in the book into this app.
Right.
And I'm, as a result, it gets unwieldy.
So you guys are you guys are pretty old school. Do you miss the multi-window Xcode?
I don't.
No, eh?
I did initially.
Because there was some clamoring for like this single giant IDE, which is common to other platforms.
If the simulator would work better with full screen mode, I would run it full screen mode.
Oh, God, yeah. And documentation. Documentation and the simulator.
Right. Those two things. Yep.
Give me those in full screen. For me, the only time I really miss multiple windows is when I'm working on a nib and code at the same time. I do not like that side-by-side editor thing. It's just, it just doesn't work for me.
Yeah. That right-hand panel. When we're editing a nib, I mean, it's essential.
Yeah.
And then most of the other time, I don't want it there.
Oh, God. Yeah.
And I could probably set up some kind of behavior, but I mean, I'm messing with it all the time. And
I submitted a radar saying that should be, you know, show and hide the panel based upon the file extension.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I only ever want to see it for an XIB or an NIB.
Right.
That's all. Yeah. And people wonder why there's no nib support in Chameleon.
Is that why? Is it a chicken or an egg thing?
I use nibs in my Mac OS X code, but the iOS code, no.
Okay, so let's just, for the listening audience, Chameleon is effectively a UI kit port to the Mac that Sean wrote in order to... In service of Twitterific on the Mac, am I right?
Right.
Now it doesn't have nib support in that while it is a port of the APIs, you can't actually load a nib, so you can't quite reuse what some people may write for iOS, whether loading nibs, you can't just take that to the Mac. And there's a couple of reasons for that. A, apparently Sean hates nibs. And B, the nib file format is undocumented. If you did load it, it would be a brutal hack anyway.
There are some branches of Chameleon on GitHub where people have reverse engineered it and gotten it to work.
Did they take the code from Newstep? Because I know those guys were loading nibs at one point. Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know. I've never even looked.
Yeah. So, okay. So what's your beef with Nibs?
I don't know. I've never had luck with them. What I don't like about it is how it splits half of the, essentially half the logic is in this closed container, you know, that you can't peek inside. And then the other half is in code, right? You can't ever do everything with a nib. You know, inevitably there's some property you have to set or something you want to set, you know, based on some code. And so now it's like, to me, that violates like the cleanliness. You know, you can't just look at the code and see what's going on because this button label might have a weird font or, you know, something else in the nib, but you don't know that in the code. Mm-hmm. It's stuff like that that really bothers me. I don't know. It might just be me.
No, I've heard other people say that.
I can understand. And one thing that's a problem, and I've noticed this, you know, on my Mac code base, is that when you're doing it in the two places and something's gone wrong, you got to look in two places. You got to first determine whether, okay, am I setting this attribute in the nib or am I setting it in code? Right. So you go look at them, and it's kind of hard to find them in the nib sometimes. It's gotten better, but it's still, you know, is it a attribute on the view, the cell, the formatter for that cell? It's, you know, is it a binding or is it not a binding?
It turns into a mess.
It's a hunt. You're hunting for the thing that you know is wrong.
Right.
In our case with Twitterific 5, with the theming, the nibs make even less sense. I mean, the code has to change almost everything. You know, the nib would never look anything like the UI. So it doesn't seem worth it. You know, it's like basically you're using the nib to avoid typing in a couple of frames.
Right. Well, I mean, when iOS started, there was no nib support for, I don't know what.
True.
How many years? Like, took a while.
Yeah, it took a long time. I didn't come from a Mac background for programming, and so I got
just
into
about
iOS.
To ask that. Yeah.
I'm psychic. I got into iOS stuff with the very first iPhone with the jailbreak,
right,
and class dumps. And since I didn't come from a Mac background, I didn't even know Objective C. So I learned Objective C by reading class dumps. You know, and I didn't know anything about like nibs, and I didn't really know how to do view controllers correctly. You know, none of that stuff was documented.
I think that's so awesome. I mean, you know, there were two kinds of excitement with the jailbreak stuff. The longtime Mac developers who saw UI table view for the first time, and it's got a data sort, it's got a delegate. Bam, I understand it. Yeah. And the other people were like, wow, what is this strange language with class dump and methods and you know, and it's, well, Sean, tell them about the thing you did, the app a day.
Oh yeah, that was, I don't remember which year this was. It was before there was the App Store, the year before the App Store in November. I did an iPhone app every day during the jailbreak era. And I did that because my wife was doing the NaNoWriMo, the novel in a month thing. So I did an app a day. And, you know, they were terrible, terrible apps. But
do you have any highlights?
Well, I think I had the very first level.
Yeah, cool.
I think I had the first air hockey. And I had the first wallpaper sharing app, I think, that also turned into a porn sharing app.
wait, which one was that?
Wallpaper.
I'll send it to you later.
No, I think Tapulous picked that one up, right?
Right. I think I was employee number one or two, with Tapulous. And part of the deal was they took all that stuff. Not that it was, you know, really worth anything, but they actually did try to turn wallpaper into a real product. But, and it was, if I remember right, it was for a while before the App Store, because Tapulous started selling stuff prior to the App Store.
Yeah, I remember that because they had Mechanical Turk guys making sure there's no penises on it.
Yeah, we had Turk filtering the wallpaper app, and the other app, Collage, was the other app like that I did. And they both had the same problem.
Did you do the fortune cookie one?
I didn't do fortune cookie. No.
Okay. Do you know the story? You've heard the story about the Secret Service?
No, I don't know if I heard that story. I was there during that, but
so. Well, I was on the phone with them at one point. I was doing contracting around this time with those
you
guys.
You were on the phone with the Secret Service?
No, I was on the phone with Bart, who's the guy that was running Tapulous at the time, because I was doing a bunch of contracting. And if you've never spoken to Bart, he talks like a mile a minute. He just keeps going. There's no stopping him. And suddenly he just stops and says, I got to go to the Secret Services here, and hangs up on me. And I'm like, what the hell is this? So apparently – the Tapulous had been shipping this app called Fortune Cookie, which was, as you'd expect, a fortune cookie. And you would, I think you'd tap the screen a lot and it would crack open. And Louis Mattia, I think, did the art for it. And then out would pop your fortune. Now, the thing is, the fortunes were user submitted. And somebody had submitted a death threat towards Barack Obama. And so the Secret Service gets wind of it and sort of drops by the office to make sure that there's no plot to assassinate the president hidden in a crummy little iPhone app.
Clint Eastwood was there looking.
Yeah. Well, probably.
That's great.
It was probably top secret or something. So anyway.
Well, the problem, I mean, I'm in Iowa and I was in Iowa back then too. So I missed out on a lot of stuff.
Good call.
It's amazing, looking back on those days, of how many influential people were at Tapulous. I mean, there's Sean, there was Mike Lee.
Is it Mantia?
Matt Louis was there.
Tristan
and Tierney. Yeah. Layton did something for you guys too, didn't he? Layton Duncan?
He worked on Twinkle, yeah. Like one of the first mixed Twitter / private social network things.
And these are all people that are still, like, you know, leaders in the iOS community. It's pretty amazing that you guys were all not necessarily all physically located in the same place, but mentally located in the same place.
No, Bart was he is an interesting guy, but he was definitely on top of this. I mean, he grabbed everybody.
All right.
And just threw stuff against the wall and see what worked. And it turned out that, you know, that it was Nate's tap-tap. Revenge.
Revolution. Nate True. Yep. That's another guy. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what really caught, you know, but sadly none of my stuff really caught, you know, if we hadn't filtered the content, it probably would have caught.
Yeah, wallpaper would have been a whole new thing.
Well, the sad thing about wallpaper was everyone loved that app and Apple did not allow you to set the wallpaper.
Oh, right.
Once the store came out, we couldn't do that app. It was by far the most popular app. Maybe next to, you know, TTR. Mm-hmm. But we couldn't even bring it to the store.
Yeah, I've always wondered why that there is no API to set the wallpaper. Because it seems like a fairly, you know, benign thing to be doing. You know, it's like...
somebody's going to set an ad. Guarantee
well,
it.
Well, no, but then it's like, you know, put up a thing. Do you want to let such and such an ad app access your wallpaper or something like that? Yeah, but yeah, somebody would you know, have a free app that
puts penises on the background.
It's possible that wallpaper was their motivation for not doing that. Because I had heard, and I don't know how true this is, but I had heard that there were several people in Apple that watched the App a Day project and were using it as evidence that they needed to have an app store. Right. Mm-hmm. Like there was still a war internally at the time between those who wanted the lockdown platform and those who wanted a more traditional, you know, developer platform.
That whole thing for me was just, I knew the engineers wanted to do it. I mean, the fact that it was based on Objective-C and it had a framework that was very familiar to all of us, it just felt like, okay, this is something that they want to make. You know, productize and make public APIs with. I think the whole thing, you know, once we saw, you know, the NDA not get withdrawn after, you know, iOS 2 shipped, it was pretty clear that it was Apple management that was like trying to protect its intellectual property more than, you know, build a developer ecosystem. But it was just, it was so obvious that that there was just like this, the floodgates were waiting to open. And they, you know, there's.
I forgot about that NDA thing. There's still no good rationale that I can come up with.
Oh, it's purely from a business, you know, intellectual property.
The personalities of the executives.
Point of view. Yep.
Yeah, but I mean, it's still useless. I mean, like, all it takes is somebody at Google to get your, you know, pay the whatever it was, $99 and get your SDK. And
the NDA probably legally protects them, though, that if they could prove that someone at Google, you know, implemented a feature because they saw it in the SDK, they can put the NDA.
Reverse engineering kind of thing, right? It's like you got to reverse engineer it without any documentation. And if you've signed up for the SDK and become a developer,
right,
you just gave yourself a documentation, and I'm sure some lawyer could use that in court against you somehow.
The funny thing is, though, that they were using the NDA to guys like you who had reverse engineered it without any documentation. So kind of pointless. What do you miss from the old days? Was there a freedom to it? Was it like that frontier kind of thing that you kind of miss now? Because stuff's getting pretty, I mean, Twitter's getting restricted. The platform has solidified. It's, you know, it's more of a stable and known quantity now. Is there anything you miss from having all the uncertainty back in the day? Back in the day, 5 years ago, whatever, you know.
For me, I don't know. I like moving forward. I sort of miss what might be termed the simplicity of it. You know, the APIs were simpler, although not as nice in some respects. Definitely before the App Store, they were terrible. Mm-hmm. But
the thing that
is kind of, it's frustrating now, but it's also kind of hopeful, is that there's just so many of us, the developers, you know, like that's both a good thing and a bad thing. It's hard to do something fun and interesting, but small and be noticed.
The thing I was going to say, I miss being a big fish in a small pond. You know, I'm trying to think back at the launch of the App Store in, what was it, 2007 or 2008?
Yeah, June 2008.
2008, I think. Yeah.
It was announced in 2007. That's it. You know, on day one, there were like, you know, what, 50,000 apps or something like that. Like, that was a lot.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Considering, right? I mean, that's like almost like per day. But, you know, there's so much. And that's my beef still. They have gotten better. I like the fact that they're doing editor's choices now, which calls out really well done apps. I think they need to do more of that. But the problem is always finding a good version of something you need to do. Right? That, you know, I don't want to use Twitter apps as an example because, you know, there's so many of them and they all have different personalities. It's kind of a UI playground for a lot of people. But, you know, we recently took my wife and I took a trip to London, and I was like, we wanted the best app to, you know, to have timetables for the underground and public transport. And it was really hard to find that app. It's like, no, there's no place to go and says, oh, this is the best one. And, you know, we eventually found one that was good. But, you know, in the process, we found apps that crashed when they couldn't make a network connection. We found apps that, you know, weren't caching any information so that as soon as you got underground, you couldn't use it. Well, having an underground app that doesn't work underground kind of sucks. You know, so it's because there are a lot of developers out there. There are a lot of people still learning how to do stuff. There's probably several hundred thousand iOS developers now. You know, maybe 10% of who are, you know, completely versed in doing development and, you know all the ins and outs and the tricks and, you know, have developed a network of other developers who they can ask questions of and that kind of thing. So it goes back to this iOS is, it's in the early days, right? You know, you just said, all of 5 years ago, back in the old days, 5 years is nothing. right? What's it going to be like in 25 years, 30 years? That's where it's going to be really interesting. And I think, you know, we'll have devices that are a lot more capable. I think we'll have developers that are a lot more capable. It's going to be pretty awesome. And Sean has a son who's... Has Amos ever used a keyboard?
No.
Yeah.
Not short of...
Wow, that's awesome.
You know, just tapping around. But he doesn't have to, right? He has real trouble with mice as well. Trackpads. Mm.
Because of the disassociation between the movement and the pointer on screen?
Yeah, the indirection. I mean, he's only 4, but at the same time... You know, I know other 4-year-olds who grew up without the iPads and stuff, and they're very, very good at their computers, you know, and he's not. I don't see that as a bad thing, really, because it's not a hard skill to learn. It's just that both of my kids still, every time they see a screen, the first thing they try is to touch it.
I think that's so awesome because that's, you know, he's 4 years old. He's born at essentially the beginning of the iOS revolution. You know, the whole touch-based revolution. And, you know, in 30 years, he's going to be a young adult. Right? And he's never going to, you know, it's like talking to people today who had never gone into a bank to get money.
He will never know a blue.
They don't know that there was life before ATMs.
Right.
Or even
Right, yeah. You line up and talk to the teller.
You know, compact discs. It's like, what? You had to have
in all honesty,
discs.
That's me. I never used a bank.
Really? Oh, man.
There was just no reason
to. Then you go back to, telephones used to have cords on them, too. You couldn't walk around the house.
I saw my godkids at their grandmother's asking why they didn't know what a commercial was. They'd never seen one. She had regular old cable, and all their stuff was on a PVR. They could watch it when they wanted. They didn't know why they couldn't watch the show they wanted.
My kids are like that too. We don't. That's cool. We don't have cable TV or anything like that. We just use iTunes.
So looking forward to the future. A lot of rumblings about like AppKit sort of reaching the end of its days. Sean, you probably haven't done a lot of work with AppKit, but what you have done is port UIKit to the Mac, effectively. What do you think about having that paradigm on the Mac? Does it fit well? Was it hard for you to shoehorn stuff in? With the weird edge cases, it didn't make sense.
Naturally, the first Mac app I tried to write was Chameleon. But
would you say you've got a contempt for the Mac? Like you're like an iOS guy, and you're just going to make everything look like iOS?
Core animation is just so vastly superior to the old model.
Sure.
It's just that it's not like that in AppKit. You know, like it's so bolted on, and you can tell. It's gotten better, even in the time when I was writing Chameleon, because it was, 10.6, I think, was current then. And, like, each OS 10 release has gotten a lot better. Like, you can tell they're moving AppKit towards that themselves.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think they see that as a better, cleaner future as well.
Yeah, 10.8's actually pretty decent for that kind of stuff. They fixed a bunch of stuff with the text rendering and some of the issues like that. Yeah.
They kept flipping the coordinates around, which was really bonkers. Like the layer coordinates versus the window coordinates.
Yeah, layers, yeah.
It's all legacy, right? You know, you look at look at NS window versus UI window. Right? It's like you go look at the NS window documentation, it's like there's all these weird methods. It's and there's hundreds of them.
Yeah, that's why the approach I took with Chameleon was to build the UI window on top of a view, not NS window, right? Like I didn't even go that route because I could tell that NS window was just too weird, too different from how UIKit thinks about it. So I built the entire UIKit stack on core animation views, and so your whole app lives within a single NS view. Not a window. And I think Lauren took a slightly different approach with his TWUI or whatever that was that he wrote at Twitter.
Yeah, nobody can pronounce it.
Yeah.
Tweet.
Well, he did a similar thing as Chameleon, right? He took UIKit conventions and brought it to the Mac, but he built it on top of NS Views, I believe. So it worked more like a traditional Mac app would.
Yeah.
So, you know, that had obvious like text rendering benefits.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't get the UI view controllers and all that other
good stuff. He couldn't bring
as a result
the whole stack over.
Yeah, I know.
But for a guy like Lauren, that's not a problem. It's like, oh, I'm just going to write my own UI kit on top of OpenGL, and it's only for a game.
Like, yeah, well, yeah. The guy's a bit over the top. That guy.
He's awesome. He's plain awesome. But
now I'm glad he's out of Twitter again. Not out of any animosity towards Twitter, but just it's cool to have him out and about in the, on the scene because he's doing cool stuff. So I talked to we talked to Paul Haddad and the Tapbots guys, and they did their Mac thing based on AppKit.
Which he hates.
Yeah, he wants to see die, but he went with it just because it was the more native sort of thing. But do you see? I mean. I guess it's kind of doesn't make a lot of sense to ask you about this, but will Apple try to transition to sort of a more UIKit sort of feel, like either UIKit or AppKit 2? Is that something you think we can expect?
I think that if they do, it'll be like a UIKit 3. Mm-hmm. From what I can tell, they took everything they did wrong in AppKit and fixed it in UIKit. But UIKit's not perfect. Yeah. So my thought is that if they do come back to the Mac, Apple does seem to have a philosophy of not doing like Chameleon. I don't think they would do Chameleon. Yeah. And I don't think they have any intention of doing that. So if they do come back to the Mac, they'll probably come back with, okay, let's scrap it. Let's start with everything we did right in UIKit. and then go from there.
I guess my question is if they really need to do that. I mean, that the whole UI framework is just a piece of most developers' puzzle. It's, you look at the frameworks that Apple has done that are available both on iOS and on the Mac, things like Game Center and iCloud and, all that stuff. It's all service oriented, right? They've got these frameworks that sit on top of services, and services are kind of like the area where they're the weakest right now. But they have also it's a strategic thing for them, right? Things like iCloud and having your data available on all the devices that they want to sell you is a big deal for them, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of infrastructure there that they've already. Are working on making cross-platform. So the actual UI that sits on top of that, I don't know. Did they really need to sit and make it so that you can share your view controllers between the Mac and iOS?
They probably don't. I mean, in theory, if you design your app correctly, you don't need to do that, right? Like, not to say that, Twitterific 4 was terrible, but we both know that rewriting it all for the Mac would have been hell.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, Twitterific 5 is far better engineered, but, so it probably would be easier to write just a shell and put the rest of the app into it, which I'm sure is what they would prefer people did anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Share your models and then, make platform-specific views and controllers. Yeah, or even if you're smart, you can make your views work cross-platform, by using core animation and things like that. So, then you're really just talking about the controllers,
right?
Which how hard is that?
The thing that I find most fascinating about UIKit. And the documentation and stuff is how Apple effectively educates us.
Hmm.
Right? They have all these years of experience because a lot of these guys who designed UIKit also designed, NextStep, right? I mean, they go way back. They've made the same mistake multiple times and have fixed it multiple times, in different ways until they find what works. And that's an experience that and end app developer just doesn't get to have. So there's like lessons baked into UIKit's design.
That
I can see. I can't really like state what they are, but I can see them there.
Well, there's no cells, first of all.
The getting rid of cells, and it's interesting. You go back to look at some of the jailbreak APIs that were in iOS 1.0, and there's a lot of stuff in there that was just this. Okay, it works, but like table views was a little bit. I forget the details. I just remember table views these are kind of a pain in the butt. Oh yeah, it was there was no cell reuse and stuff like that. And
Even the first iOS 2 when it came out, you could only reuse one table cell.
Yeah, yeah,
something like that. It was all it's pretty janky.
Anybody who had done any jailbreak work knew that table view needed help. And guess what? 2.0, it was a lot better. Mm-hmm. And that's what, Sean said earlier. It's like, 2.0 came out. It was awesome. Well, it was awesomer. I mean, iOS 3 came out and it was even awesomer. And iOS 4 came out and it was even more awesomer.
Right.
In fact,
in fairness, they weren't trying to pretend that iOS 1 was awesome in terms of an API.
I think that's, it goes back to that's why they didn't make it a public API, because the engineers knew it's like, this is the first version. We're going to throw it away and make the one that everybody sees. And they do that. They do that now with any new framework. Mm-hmm. It's like the action sheet or not that. What do they call them? Where,
the
sharing sheet, right? And how all that stuff works. I'm sure in the next version of iOS, we're going to see something that lets third parties do that, because, Apple's working out the details internally. They're, getting their own apps to use it. They're seeing what parts work well, what parts don't work well, tune the API, run it through code review, blah, blah, blah. And then, because they know that once it goes public, they can't change the APIs, right? Yeah. That screws everybody. So, right.
I mean, which is why you get, 20, 30 years down the road, that's why you get NS Window with a method that still wants to draw color,
Right. Right.
It's, yes, I'd like color in my window, please. Thank you. So what do you guys want to see? Maybe not the next release, but what functionality is missing from iOS that you guys would like to see that you either have a product idea for or would make your lives easier?
Inter-application communication.
Yeah.
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 I mean, they do have XPC. They're just not, it's not public in any way.
Right. Yeah. And URL schemes have got major limitations. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you did a lot of early work with that too.
Yeah. That's something that you can use. It's just the user experience isn't real great. It requires a contract between both parties who are using it. It's hard to, add on to it.
It's not formalized in any way.
Yeah,
I remember you either filing bugs or going on a bit of a rampage because you couldn't tell if somebody would implement the URL? You had to just call it and then it would never fail.
I submitted a radar about that. And lo and behold, now we have can open URL. Yay.
Thanks. Thanks, Craig.
I was actually responsible for view did unload or view will unload. I forget which one it is.
Cool.
It's like, they had load view, but they didn't have unload view. So you never knew when the view got unloaded and couldn't clean up and of course that's all for naught now because they don't ever call, or they never unload the view when there's a memory warning for you.
Oh yeah, they stopped doing that. Yeah.
That was a very smart thing that they did. I mean, that's again, Apple looking at how people use their stuff work. They see a lot of crash logs happening because, the view's reference went away and the app didn't know it.
Right. Plus the devices have a bit more memory.
Yeah.
And they can always just kill you if they need to. Well, like a controlled K killing of an app is a bit different than it just suddenly exploding.
Yeah. You know? Well, one of the things that, that we did in Twitterific 5 is that you know, all of the views and view controllers just stick around, right? Mm-hmm. We don't bother unloading view controllers because the memory footprint for the view controller and the view is low. It's the, you know, the models that view controller uses, which tend to be heavy, right? It's mm-hmm. you know, core data objects and, you know, cached information and stuff like that. And, you know, that when we get a memory warning, we throw away. And, you know, it really helps. So, you know, it's the fact that Apple did this thing with views and explained to WWDC why they did it made us think, you know, well, that's pretty smart. You know, how does this affect other parts of the app? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's like we don't worry about cleaning up view controllers anymore. And it's great. You know, it's just it lets your code be smarter and work better.
David also said that you created the app in such a way that he didn't have to keep making new assets. He could just go in and tweak colors and all of the UI, or at least a lot of the UI would be represented programmatically, which he liked a lot.
You get to explain that, Sean.
it's Sean just recreated the nib is what he did.
Well, we actually use the iOS 5 UI appearance stuff where you can apply... it's almost like a style sheet, although it's not quite that good, but you can apply, you know, colors and fonts and things like that to whole classes. So no matter where they show up. So we used that. We abused it would be a more accurate statement.
Do you load them from like plists or something? Load a bunch of settings from a file that you can edit?
We were originally going to do that, but instead I just made some macros that were easy enough. Mm-hmm. And it's like in a big theme file, .m kind of thing. And he just went in there and did it.
Yeah, okay. So basically it's like a little micro language that you just tweak stuff and yeah. That's cool. That's a good idea.
Having a designer who can tweak his own colors, his own images, his own, you know, offsets for views mm-hmm. and insets and all that stuff was just awesome. It's like, you know, anybody who's done just, you know, raw HTML, you know, that mm-hmm. you know, put an H1, put a div. You know, here's a span that, you know, and a, you know, developer makes some code that emits that stuff and then hands it over to a designer who edits a CSS file. It's exactly mm-hmm. like that. It's awesome because, you know, designers know how to place those elements, how to make them look pretty, you know, how to, you know, put backgrounds on them, that kind of stuff. And then if they don't like something, they tweak it. Right? Right. And you don't have to know about it.
Yeah, I love that kind of stuff. When I was doing games, a lot of them are very data-driven. And it, like you write the pipeline and the engine, and then artists just sort of give you assets to stick in. And like one of the most awesome things is coming in the morning and seeing that like an artist has written, like has made something appear on the screen that you just didn't think was possible because he's tweaked your shaders or he's, you know, using a model in an innovative way. And just having like... enabling designers to be able to, you know, get their best work done through your code base is so gratifying to me. And I think, you know, I think anybody that appreciates good design wants to let those guys just sort of cut loose.
Yeah. Yeah. Let them shine.
I got introduced to that. One of the only games I've ever really done was Ramp Champ.
Right. Exactly.
And yeah. We wrote an editor. I guess actually that was my first Mac app now that I think about it.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
It wasn't very good. But anyway, there was the editor.
It worked.
Yeah, it was really cool because they could, they just went nuts with it. You know, they could define all the rules and attach them to the different targets and move it around. And, you know, it didn't have like live previews and stuff, but it was good enough. And so they did stuff that I didn't think was possible. And
how it's so gratifying, right? Like you wrote all of the tools, you wrote the thing that's playing the game, and you wrote the editor that kicks it out. And then somebody comes along and you're like, that shouldn't be possible.
Yeah.
I don't know how you did that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's that moment where you come in the morning, you do your, you know, SVN up or, you know, get magic or whatever. And, you know, you do that first build in the morning and you go, holy crap. Right. It feels so awesome. And that happened a lot. That happened, in fact, and as a developer, it inspires you as well. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, that looks really good. Oh, you know, but this we could do a little bit better view animation or something like that here. Yeah. Right? It's like, oh, it looks so awesome now. It's got to be more awesome, right?
Yeah, you get into positive feedback
loop. Editors like that are dangerous though too, because they think it's easy.
Yeah.
You guys also managed to both hide the status bar and still allow the tap to scroll into the top functionality.
Yeah, well, the funny thing is some guy tweeted, oh, that's just a standard thing that iOS does.
Like, well, because Safari does that in Landscape View, so that automatically assumes it's an open API.
Yeah, it is so easy.
But that's a case where Apple's documentation is simply astounding. If you read enough of it, it tells you exactly how it works. Right, and like in that situation, if you read between the lines of the documentation for like the scroll to top stuff and UI scroll views docs, it essentially tells you every method it calls and just about the order it calls them in. You know, you just have to like really be looking for it. And so I applied that and just walked the view hierarchy myself. And lo and behold, it just works great. It even works with web views, you know, which don't really expose their internals. But it just works without breaking any rules, right? I'm not doing anything against the App Store policy there.
Yeah, that's one of the benefits of having worked on the platform for a while, is that you know, like when you know how the whole thing sort of put together, you can come up with solutions that don't actually, they're not illegal, they're just clever.
Right.
It helps to have also written
right.
One more.
Yeah, does that give you a lot of insight into, like, do you think the way that Chameleon works is how UIKit works, or is it mostly API compatible? Like, does one give you insight into the other?
Oh, totally. Chameleon probably does things very differently and less safe and rougher. But I did spend an awful lot of time digging into, like, arcane stuff, you know, like I would do a navigation view, UI navigation controller, and see when it decided to actually remove popped controllers from its view controllers array and things like that. Like I would try to figure it out, you know, was it before the run loop ran once, or, you know, like was it delayed or not, things like that. And I would try to replicate that as much as I could. And then that would give insight into how they're maybe doing it internally, you know? So I would spend a day thinking, God, that's the stupidest thing I've ever seen. You know, why is this behaving this way? Then you sleep on it, wake up the next day, and you're thinking, oh, but it enables like these 10 other side behaviors. That's cool.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. One of the UI table, this has happened a while ago, but UI table view used to have a problem where if a cell was first had a view that was first responder and it got reused, there were some problems, you know, crashy kind of behavior, because the first responder wasn't there anymore. And
yeah, prior to like iOS 5, if you removed the first responder from view, it didn't bother to clear that. So the moment you like hit a key or equivalent, you know, something that ran down the responder chain, it would crash.
Yeah, the responder chain on iOS is pretty wacky.
Yeah, the thing that was interesting is that Apple fixed that bug, and then we had the problem show up in Chameleon. So it kind of showed us that the way Sean had implemented in Chameleon was, you know, the same way that, you know, and he then fixed it like Apple fixed it.
So that's cool.
I probably wrote like 20 lines of code in Chameleon. You know, I had nothing to do with it, but I was the first person who used it as a developer, and it was pretty awesome from that regard. And
you know. So that's a big project.
Yeah.
Was it hard to sign off on that? Was it like, this is crazy?
I just didn't tell him.
Well, no, you Perfect. Told me, okay. But you told me, but after you had gotten enough of it done that it was like, oh yeah, this shouldn't be too hard to do.
Right, because that seems like a weird meeting. Like, you know what? I'm just going to go away and rewrite UI kit. It's like, no, it's going to take years. So you had a proof of concept in hand, right? So
yeah, well, yeah. One of the beauties of working with Sean is that he often goes off and does little projects that you're not quite sure why he's doing it, but I've gotten to the point where I trust him, and you know. For a little bit, at least. Right? Just like go off and explore, experiment, and we'll figure out if this is something we can do or not. It's like in Twitterific 5, the gestures. Mm-hmm. We had no gestures in the first beta.
Oh, really?
Okay. They just weren't there. And David and Sean went off and they were we're working on something cool. Yeah, that's kind of not the thing you don't want to hear during a beta, right? Yeah. Your feature complete? Are you just fixing bugs?
Oh, it was that late in the show, eh?
Yeah.
It was pretty late. I remember I was sitting in a hospital waiting room or something, and just, you know, waiting for a doctor or something, and David and I are iMessaging back and forth, and we concocted this whole plan on a Sunday. And then it completely revolutionized the app.
The thing about Twitterific 5 is it's so fast. I've joked that it's almost like Star Wars Blast Shield closing fast, but literally you press something and it is immediately there.
Yeah. The beauty of Sean and I working together, in fact, I did this on the post on Furbo, is that we kind of challenge each other. In fact, there's some optimizations we did that got thrown away. Because they didn't really help the overall performance like we thought they would. We thought that we could eke a little bit more performance out of the app by adding and removing table view cells intelligently, you know, minimizing the amount of work as far as, you know, row height calculations are concerned. And it turns out that didn't help. So it's like I probably spent 3 or 4 days working on that code, and it's like, didn't help. Throw it away. But, you know, he was working on the view stuff and I was working on the model stuff. And it was always like, okay, how can I make the model faster so that Sean can draw the views faster? And he was always trying to make the views more responsive so that he didn't have to access the data as much and that, mm-hmm. that kind of stuff.
Blame avoidance optimization.
Blame you, Junior.
Ah, okay. So yeah, what does the stack look like? You've got a network layer, then you pull it into, you mentioned core data before.
Yeah.
Do you use core data as sort of the model objects? Is that what gets fed to the UI, or do you have an intermediary level there?
The model can return stuff out of the core data objects. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the objects that it returns are user objects, status objects, direct message objects, and things like that. Okay. And those can come out of the database cache while simultaneously pulling in updated results from the Twitter API. So the core data and the network stack are working together simultaneously. There's a lot of blocks. Initially I wrote the model separate from the app. Just a couple reasons for that. One is I wanted to be able to automate the testing of this stuff and, you know, run it at speeds a user never would be doing it at, just to make sure that there weren't any deadlocking or, you know, that kind of problem with the blocks and all of that multi-threaded code. The other reason for doing that is that Sean wasn't quite ready to display the views for that data. So that's kind of when we started to split the work, between us. And then, you know, from that point on, I continued to, well, actually that it's interesting. While he was still working on the views and all the controller containment hierarchy stuff, I did the Xscope Retina update, which took longer than I thought it would. So there was like a month and a half, let's say, where I wasn't working on the model. But I got the model working enough and had documented the APIs enough for him that he could continue doing his stuff. And then once got Xscope done, he had a lot of suggestions about how the model could improve.
So, in order to better suit the way the UI worked?
Yeah. We had basically originally had the view controllers talking directly to the model objects or the Twitter model. And it turned out that the timeline views, you know, they spent a lot of time and effort, you know, managing the rows of data that they needed to display. So we built an intermediate layer that we call providers, which do that, you know, the core data, back end networking, all of that stuff, and makes it very easy for the timeline to grab the stuff it needs and display. And that's the thing that's sort of like the fetch results controller.
Right.
So.
And it's all asynchronous using blocks, I suppose. Like there's no, you don't block on anything. Yeah.
Well, there are times where you have to block.
It's, sure.
Yeah. You know, core data still has to, some stuff that has to happen on the main thread. In fact, there is a little bit of stutter if you know exactly where to look for it and when to look for it. Once you start using blocks, you really can feel when a device has one CPU core versus when it has two. There's a real, it's like it's pretty obvious that a 3GS does not and an iPhone 5 does.
Right.
And just being able to do more than one thing at a time.
Was that, were blocks difficult for you to pick up, or did you just sort of go to it naturally?
Conceptually, the high-level stuff is really easy to pick up. Mm-hmm. The wrapping your head around stuff that's going to execute out of order and results, you know, the unpredictability of it, and coming to terms with, you know, you're just telling things to start. You don't know necessarily when they're going to finish, or the order in which they finish is not predictable. Mm-hmm. That takes a while to wrap your head around. But once you do, and you start thinking that way, it's pretty easy.
It's almost sort of like the event loop for your app, where just user inputs coming to you as events, sort of random, not randomly, but at the will of the user. I imagine with your providers and stuff like that, stuff's coming back at you depending on network latency or how long it takes a core data fetch to come, or
right,
it's dealing with a bunch of different events in a different, you know, different aspect of your application.
Yeah. In fact, I to be honest, I don't fully get it yet. And Sean is a lot better at this. In fact, he finds problems in my code that where stuff is being retained by the block. Mm-hmm. That's the area where I tend to get hung up, and it's like, okay, is self getting retained here? And if was, so right. Why? And you know, of course that leads to things like, okay, well, self is retained, so it's not necessarily going to get freed up when you think it's going to get freed up. And you know, it's the alloc method, which cuts, you know, turns, you know, tears the service down, doesn't get called because, you know, it's like it's.
Yeah, ugly retain
cycle.
That's
the other. Yeah.
Yeah, all the stuff that Arc has trained you not to think about, blocks, force you to think about. Yeah.
You know what? I wrote a bunch of code with garbage collection and blocks, and it is amazing. It is, well, it's not amazing because most of garbage collection is kind of bust, but with blocks it's great because you don't have to worry about any of that kind of stuff. It just works. Like it cleans itself up. It doesn't get retain cycled. It's great. It's you write the code as you're thinking about it. You don't need that wacky, you know, weak self reference and all that. So
it's kind of a miracle that, I don't know if miracle's the right word, abomination. That blocks even exist, you know, in a C-like language like this without garbage collection. Yeah. I mean, in something like Smalltalk, they're just obvious. Mm-hmm. But in C, I mean, because that's where they implemented it at the C level. Yeah. It's just crazy. It is pretty tough to get your head around.
Yeah,
Arc is Arc is so awesome. I feel bad though for new developers who can start writing code and not understand what retain and release is all about.
Yeah.
Because they're going to get bit hard at some point. I mean, hard.
Well, what they did with Arc was they went to Stack Overflow in the Objective-C section and said, let's all make this work. And then they introduced blocks at like the same time and then shot themselves in the foot.
Yeah. I don't know if I'm old school or just old, but
you're old school.
I'm both. Yeah. Like I do feel that knowing how memory works is kind of an important
thing. Exactly.
You know, like both malloc and free or new and delete and C or alloc and retain and release or copy. Like at a certain point you have to realize that, well, I'm making something and I've got to get rid of it because there's, you know, finite space.
Well, yeah, that's the difference between, you know, like a real programmer and like a noob.
Well, you know, like, it's not necessarily a noob, though, because
the problem with Arc is that it lulls you into this false sense of security.
Right. And at some point it's, you know, even if you just use a CF object, you know.
Yeah, you're done.
Yeah, exactly. Now you need to know about memory, you know? Sorry, we cut you off.
I was just going to say that it's not necessarily that they're noobs in the programming sense, but they're noobs in the Objective-C sense. Mm-hmm. I see a lot of people who have been working in JavaScript and on the web and have a pretty good conceptual grasp of, you know, C-like languages in using JavaScript. So, in Java, everything's garbage collected, right? You know, they haven't had to know how that's, you know, objects get thrown away.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, Arc for those people is great, but then, yeah, you're like, you know, you hit Cork Foundation or, you know, some retain cycle in a block or something like that. And then it's, that's why I say they're going to get bit hard, right? You know, conceptually they understand what's going on, but then there's this fairly low level thing that they just don't understand at all.
Right. And it's because while, yeah, that's memory, it's not just memory. It's that's like the fundamental resource pattern for computers. Like if you want to make a texture, that you got to create it and destroy it. If you want to make a file, you got to create it and destroy it. Like there's, you know, open a network connection, you got to open and close it. All of these things, it's a pretty fundamental resource usage pattern, really, that I think kind of gets overlooked a bit. So I'm assuming Twitterific 5 ships with Arc then, since you're fans.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Was that the first big project that you did?
There are a few classes in there that don't use it just because it's like they're small little classes. It's like, I'm not going to bother doing this.
Which should be pointed out is another cool thing about Arc is that you can mix and match.
Yeah. Yeah, it's totally optional. And then, you know, the code is code we've been using for a long time. You know, it's like, you know, this version of Twitterific, it's been around a while. Yeah, the whole thing is Arc. In answer to your question, is this the first project we've done with Arc? First product, that we've shipped that's been with Arc.
Mm-hmm.
We've got some internal stuff that we've
done. Did Mir use Arc? I wrote Mir, I can't remember. For Xcode,
yeah.
Was there trepidation in going with it, or is it just like, well, this it's a new app, it's a new project, so turn on all the fancy options that Apple gives us, and let's just go.
Yeah, let's learn a bunch of things we didn't already know.
There wasn't any trepidation about that, at least not for me. I more miss the fact that because of we were targeting like iOS 5, and I don't remember what the deal was. Maybe it was the Xcode version. We couldn't use the Objective-C literals, the new literals.
Oh, that's a bummer. Those are pretty cool.
Yeah, I think we probably could now. I think at the time...
Oh, that's a bummer. Those are pretty cool.
We had to submit with an older version of Xcode or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Those are nice.
There was a period of time where we wanted to use them, but we couldn't. And... I would, if I was doing a new project now, I would use them just no no second thoughts. It's just that that's Objective-C getting more awesome. Also, the synthesize and not needing to declare properties and all that stuff.
I just remembered the other day because I did it by accident, but you don't need to put, like, let's say you've got private methods within inside your class. You don't need to declare the method up in like a private interface or a class extension.
Yeah, you don't have to forward declare anymore.
Yeah, you don't have to forward declare exactly. It'll just find it, which is kind of cool.
I think Twirific 5 code still has synthesize spelled out everywhere just because of that oddness with if you leave it out, it names the IVAR with an underscore. If you put it in, it names it without one. And if you put it in with an equal sign, it names it however you want.
Yeah.
So we were just explicit about it in Twirific 5.
So do you guys use underscores or M or?
Underscore.
Underscore at least conceptually helps me realize that I'm not using a property and not use one accidentally.
Yeah.
That's purely what it is.
I really hate
myself from shooting myself in the foot.
Yeah. I dislike prefixes on my variables. I don't know why. I don't think it makes sense. I think it's because I did too much Windows programming back in the day.
Yeah.
It's like, M is gross and H wind, like,
SZ is my favorite.
String zeros, null terminated strings. Okay, it's awful. And I kind of rely on syntax.
And they had to do that because it was like the IDE sucked, right? Everybody complains about X. Yeah, this is another thing. Try going back and using Xcode 3.
Right.
Everybody who's complaining about Xcode 4, just fire up Xcode 3 and use it for a few hours.
Right. Yeah, it's significantly better. I mean, it's because we spend so much time in it, we're always, finding the rough edges.
Right. It's gotten a lot better, but everybody's still got their, it crashes. And yeah, it does crash.
Yeah.
Does your code ever crash?
Right. Yeah.
Never.
So the underscore to me does, it's almost just a reminder that the IDE is not helping me out as much as it should. Like, you really shouldn't have to decorate your instance variables or any of your other variables just to be able to determine their scope. I think it seems to me like a failure of the environment. Not that it's wrong to do it. I think I'm just stubborn and stupid, but,
Well, some sort of color coding or something like that would be probably more helpful, right?
Yeah.
Bright red if you're accessing the instance variable directly.
I think they do get color coded differently, but it's like super subtle or something.
I don't know if there's a warning. I mean, would be nice in some ways would be to have it be a warning or an error to even access the IVAR.
Yeah.
Because I mean, that, obviously that's what leaving out synthesize is supposed to remind you of, at that point it uses underscore, but it's not actually anywhere in your file.
Yeah. That is a weird choice.
But I think that's Apple trying to like educate us all, it's like, don't use an IVAR at all. Use that method, period. That's what you should do.
Yeah.
I just wish using self dot whatever in the debugger wouldn't, when you're stepping over something, pop you up into the synthesize line and then step again and you're back to where you want to be. And, it's like,
I hate that. Yeah. I hate that. When I have like a chain of properties and you're trying to find out.
Exactly.
Like step in, oh, please don't do this. Yeah.
Right. I will go so far as to, create, temporary variables for that stuff rather than have big long chains. In fact, often I will write code just so that I can step over to the debugger more easily.
Yeah, me too.
Which is, it's not as pretty. It's not as pretty. It's not as terse.
Yeah.
But
you can understand it when you're trying to. Yeah.
I know I'm going to be stepping over this code, so.
I like to throw in that ternary operator just for you.
Sean, oh, God.
Do you use that?
Bring that up.
I use it all the time.
I freaking hate the ternary operator. Sean loves it.
So I'll use it. Let's say I'm printing something out where I'm formatting a string. And the thing I want to format is nil. I'll do the question mark and the colon so that if it's not nil, it'll get included. Otherwise, I go to like a default string. And that's about the only time I use it.
That's my most common use too. Is that yeah. Usually on return values because I hate having an if and having two returns right next to each other.
Oh, I see. I do the if and have two returns only because I really like to see return reminding me that I guess it's right there. Yeah, I don't know.
Did you read that thing that Gruber posted the other day about the reading your code? Yeah. Some guy. I don't know.
All right, okay. I'll check it out. Okay. No, I didn't actually.
Oh, it's about reading code, right? How you read it, and I totally do that. I almost like read it out loud and I don't quite read it out loud, but it's like in my brain. I'm just like, and that's why I don't like the ternary operator. That colon right. Question mark. I can't parse that.
That's very interesting.
My brain just doesn't.
I see the code. Like what I mean is that. I can't quite explain it. I visually see it like it's like a shape in front of me. It's not.
What are you, Neo?
Sort of, yeah.
You know what? I do kind of know what you mean. As in, when I'm scanning a source file, I'm not even reading it. I'm just kind of seeing the pattern, like the way it indents and the way it kind of flows. And I'm like, this is probably where I'm supposed to be.
Yeah, I see that. But like, it's almost like for me, it's like I have a picture of a landscape in my head. And the code is like, I don't know, it's like Bob Ross. You know, it's like, there's a little tree over here, and, you know, it's a happy tree. And like I don't know, I'm somehow very visual about how I see my code. So maybe that's why I like to do the massive refactors that I do sometimes, where like these huge structural changes that I can do, because maybe that's why. Because I see it like that. Like I see it like a building. You know, I don't see it like a novel.
It's not creepy at all, man. That's totally normal. It's cool.
Have you guys ever seen either Brent Simmons or Jonathan White's code style?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, they're brilliant. They're brilliant dudes. They write awesome code, but man, does their code style just fucks with my brain. It totally just
John White's in particular hurts me.
Yeah. It's you know, and for them, it works great, and they can see it. I think it has a lot to do with that, you know, being able to see it and parse it.
Yeah,
but yeah, it's just there was some open source that Brent did, and it's like I downloaded that thing, and it's like, oh, where's that C code reformatter thing?
Yeah. I mean, I tend to use a lot of white space and just kind of.
Okay, you want to get me worked up again on another code formatting thing? Aligning the fucking colons. And that, having that be the default behavior in a method with a lot of parameters. Huh. Oh, Jesus. Oh.
Really? On new lines? Like on each line, you don't like when the colon lines up? Really?
I like that.
Wow. What would you rather have?
Why can't I turn it off?
You can't turn it off because it's wrong.
What would you rather have?
I like them in line. Again, I'm reading it. I mean, it's like, okay, you're trying to be poetry there?
It's not trying to be poetry. It's like on each line, there's like a new, effectively named parameter.
Oh,
right?
Okay. Then okay. What happened?
Don't yell at me. I'm sorry.
What happened? Guy, you're wrong.
I'm glad you're in California and I'm here in Montreal because it's going to say maybe you'll calm down by the time you get here.
The problem is that what happens if one of those parameters is something that itself has colons in it?
Oh yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And then it's a complete, or when it's at the end of the line, you know, if checking that the thing is not nil, ampersand, and
that's where you use the ternary operator.
Right.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. Actually, in those right. In those cases, I'd make a temporary variable and just pass it in. Yeah. But yeah, I can. Yes, you can definitely get really ugly with that really quickly.
I just want to be able to turn it off because Sean sometimes formats it that way, and I can't read it. And then
Junior,
I can't select that block. You know, hit Control I and have it be the way I like.
Yeah. Oh, you know what I would like is the auto bracket putting thing and the auto formatting for blocks to not go just totally bonkers every now and then. Like every now and then I'll put like a closing brace and it'll put like an opening brace. Like it'll be like self dot color, let's say. And I'll put a closing brace after it and it'll put the opening brace next to the self. I'm like, no, I just got to go and erase it. And then I put another one and it keeps adding them in weird random places. And then you try to do a block and it just totally flips out.
Yeah. Like, switch formatting is pretty fun too, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's I try to avoid them now. I'm like, forget it.
Right. Apple's Xcode team is making me want to use if-thens.
Right.
That's pretty much it. If-then, else-if.
Yeah, well, it's the future. No more switch.
You know, but we're pissing and moaning about something we didn't even have.
Yeah, yeah, this is good natured, camaraderie at this point.
Okay, it's like, damn it, oh, this thing isn't, you know, telling me exactly what the method signature is, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, well, you used to have to go look it up in the documentation.
Sorry, we got properties in like 2007, maybe a little earlier. Something like that. Like, I remember years just writing like accessors. You must too, you know? Like
Oh God. Yeah.
Like with that pattern where you get you get the IVAR and you like, you know, you retain the IVAR, you release the old one, then you assign the new one into the, good.
You know, the thing that I want is something where I can set a property like, you know, set color.
Right.
And somehow say, use your normal, you know, copy the color, or retain the color, whatever,
and then do this code.
But then they call it set needs display, or you know, set needs layout, or whatever.
Yes,
you know, so often you write an accessor just to have that one line of code there.
Yeah,
why isn't there a way to say, okay, I have this property named color, and anytime that gets set, I want this little bit of code to happen. You know, maybe it's a block or something like that. I don't, you know.
Yeah, I wrote.
There are smart guys at Apple that can figure that out, but that's got to happen.
Well, I wrote like a Objective-C runtime hacky thing that will call that if you implement them, we'll call like will set blah and did set blah anytime you use a property.
Mm.
But A, it's kind of slow. B, it's kind of hacky. And you could add blocks too. But what I really want is more like, you know how you can get like a key paths for values affecting key? Something like that. It's for the KVO stuff. Right. Where if I change, you know, if I change a property, then there's another property depending on it. I'd love to just be able to see, you know, if any of these keys change, then I need to set display.
Yeah. It's the same conceptual thing,
exactly.
Right? It's that you're modifying one property, which then has a side effect that you need to trigger.
Right. It's like all of these properties contribute to me rendering this thing. So if any of them change,
right,
flag me as needing display.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, it's – but, you know, that Apple knows that.
Yeah, right? Well, I'm sure
they've got smart developers who are thinking the same thing we are. It's like, why the hell am I doing this all the time? Right? It's like you know, the accessors, right?
Yeah.
Properties came to be because it's a pain in the ass to write those things.
And things have really picked up speed over the past few years.
I was going to say, someone like me who didn't come from the Mac background, Objective-C has changed every year.
Right. Yeah, like we went through, I don't know, 10 years of stagnation before, you know, the past 5 years have really been really quick. So I'm excited to see what more goodies we get. It looks like we're going to get, packages. Like you won't be importing headers anymore. I forget what
the LLVM stuff. I saw a blog post or something about that. Yeah.
That looks kind of
pretty interesting, actually.
Yeah. So that'd be neat.
And obviously, you know, namespaces, everybody, you know,
do you care about that?
How long are we going to prefix our classes and instance variables and categories and blah, 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 blah. Not instance variable category, but category methods.
Does that bother you? Do you want namespaces?
To be honest, for the the code that doesn't get shared, I don't see there being a problem.
Right.
But yeah, that there's some code that you write that you know it's going to be used by other products, other people, and it's the right thing to do. It'd be nice to be able to put that in some sort of a namespace without having the code look but ugly.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was that thing we ran into?
Oh yeah, message, the message class, and we had our core data classes without a prefix, right? I'm just, you know, again, just went into the core data modeller and, you know, it's like, so this is thing's going to be a message, so I'm going to call it a message. And you're not even thinking that it's backed by a class at that point.
Yeah.
And then the next thing you know, it's like, oh, we import the Twitter framework, which imports the Mail framework. I'm not sure why, but it did. And
the
Mail framework has a message in it. And it has for a long time. I don't know why they haven't fixed that. There's obviously some sort of problem that you know, it can't fix it for whatever reason.
Yeah, I thought I knew why at one point. Like, it would be really problematic for them to fix it somehow. Anyway, whatever.
And then I have to name all of our core data classes with a prefix, and it's just seeing IF message instead of message just bugs me.
So it's funny because you don't mind underscoring your IVARs, and I don't mind prefixing my class names. And they're both exactly the same concept.
Yeah. Well, Brent Simmons doesn't mind his coding style either, right?
Stubborn, silly programs.
It goes back to having opinions and personality. Yeah,
right.
Right. Everybody's got different opinions and different personality, and, you know, your code reflects that. Mine's all in uppercase. Sean will tell you that all my code is in uppercase. I've got macros. Let me do everything in uppercase.
You're still writing COBOL?
Hash define void.
He actually has an intern that takes his punch card.
That's
his object.
He's a wise man.
Tyler loves that.
Data section.
Craig, are you still holding out any hope for App Store fixes? I mean, like, if I search for Twitterific or search for Twitter, it's hard to find Twitterific now. You have to do a new app instead of doing upgrades still. There's no demos. You wrote one of the quintessential App Store articles right after it came out, and it seems, for as far as we've gone, there's still so much more place to go.
Well, a lot of the things in that list that I did in the second year of the App Store have improved greatly, right? The stuff about, you know, expedited reviews, we've got that now. The ability to do in-app purchases, you know, that's awesome stuff. It'd be nice to have trial versions, or at least show people a video. I mean, that's one of the things that the Google App Store has that we don't, is the ability to show people a short video of how the app works. And, you know, it's a great way to promote your app, right? You can actually see it in use. And, you know, the problem is that, you know, you can put that on your website, and how many people make it to the website from the App Store? You know, very few.
They also have 15 minutes to return the app, and you can do a refund because you know who your customers are at any time.
Right. So, I mean, there's still areas where it can improve. I'll tell you, Apple has got some pretty big usability problems with the app on iOS 6. I mean, my wife, I said nothing about it because I was just curious as to what her reaction would be. And she's great because she's just a normal person. You know, she knows what I do for a living, but she doesn't, you know the details. And to watch her use the App Store the first time, she's like, I can't search for anything. Yeah. Oh God, what is this layout? There's no list for me to scroll through. And I just, it's really taken a step back in my opinion. Considering they've acquired those companies that, make it easier to get through was it Chomp was the name of the company?
Chomp.
Yeah. They, it really hasn't gotten any better. You know, the discoverability apps is still a problem. And it goes, you know, it goes back to that, you know, me trying to find an app for the London Underground. Yeah. It's hard to do.
Mm-hmm. Actually, Vinay, does Transit cover London?
I don't believe they do England yet. That'd make them work harder.
We'll give them a call.
They're part of the empire. What the hell's wrong?
But I mean, it just seems that in terms of someone who runs a business like you do, and you have to make decisions of where to put your money and where to put your resources, the way the App Store is moving, it's not incentivizing you to make really deep, really complicated, really innovative apps because it's just so risk adverse right now as compared to like a Zynga, give them money to buy Smurfberry game.
Yeah, the one thing I would love, I don't know if Apple will ever do this or not, because it kind of exposes some of their internal workings, but I would love to know how people find our page on the App Store.
Mm.
You know, what led them there? Was it an advertisement? Was it a link on Twitter? You know, how did they get there? And, you know, once they got there, did they buy it or not? You know, some kind of analytics as far as, you know, how people find and purchase your product is essential, and it's just something we don't know. It's just, you know, you take out an ad run and you have no idea. You can tell whether, oh yeah, the sales went up, but you never advertise with just one site. You know, you got a new product out, you want to advertise on a whole bunch of sites. Well, you know, did advertising it on The Verge do better than advertising it on iMore? Or did, you know, was that link on Daring Firewall, did that send us a lot of traffic? I know the answer about Daring Firewall, but
what's that?
Yeah,
I'm just trying to be a dick. Forget it. It's an old joke. How do you manage that? Do you try to stagger your ad buys? Do you buy them all at once to get sort of a tidal wave?
We just shoot in the dark. That's all you can do.
You send people directly to the App Store, right, rather than go through your site?
Typically, yeah. Yeah. Because, again, you want to get them onto the App Store page as soon as possible.
Right.
You know, even though you may have a video and all that kind of stuff. You know, if you got a new release and, you know, there's a lot of new features in it and you want to see people to see the new features, then, you know, you might send them, like in the case of Xscope, you know, we had 70 new features, right? We wanted people to get on that features page just so they could see what's new.
Well, it's a different kind of product too than Twitterific, right? You're selling the benefits of Xscope. And I think with Twitterific, you're selling the design and the look and the visceral enjoyment of it. Does that make sense?
Yep.
I mean,
no.
Xscope is a tool, and I think Twitterific's more of an experience that you're selling.
Yeah,
if that's fair to put it that way.
In fact, it's interesting. You know, when you're selling tools versus selling, you know, consumer-oriented products, that the buying patterns are very different. Mm-hmm. For example, Flare versus Xscope. You know, both are on the Mac App Store. Both are highly ranked. Both have gotten great reviews. And about 50% of the sales for Xscope, actually probably a little bit more, somewhere between 50 and 75% are on the Mac App Store. 99.9% of Flare sales are on the App Store. People don't even bother buying Flare on our website, even though it's there. They can download a trial, all that, you know. But you know, Flare is currently on sale now for $5, right? It's like, it's kind of not worth your time to go download the trial, try it out. It's just easier to say buy, you know, put it on my hard drive, throw some photos into it. Oh, this is great.
Yeah. It is a good app. I like it a lot. Yeah. So, yeah, definitely go buy that for $5. Definitely worth checking out.
Again, every product's different. And, you know, I see a lot of people saying, you know, what's the best way to do this, this, and this? So, every product's different.
Right.
It's like every developer's different, right? It's, you've got to kind of put it out there, see how people react to it and adjust. You know, don't be afraid to make mistakes. You know, get it out there and see what happens. You know, and we've had our fair share of mistakes.
I was just going to ask, what's your
apps? We've had apps.
What's your favorite?
Just have tanked. Our favorite mistake.
Well, an app that tanks is, I don't think it's a mistake. Well, whatever. I'll let you. You know, why don't you pitch one, and we'll see which one you.
Yeah,
think
no, it's not a mistake. I mean, the astronaut is probably.
I was going to say, I don't think one. Astronaut was a mistake, and I didn't want to. I didn't want to say that. Put
it's
words
an app
in your
we
mouth.
Loved. Yeah, yeah. We're very proud of Astronaut.
You should be.
It's
great.
An app we love. Yeah. It's got everything we wanted it to be, and it was not a commercial success.
No, it's a great, charming, fun little game that I think people should go check out on iOS.
Yeah, we're very proud of it, both on the iPhone and the iPad. They're both great versions.
Games are so tough.
Again, it's back to being, you know, a small fish in a very, very big pond. Right. You know, it's people with, you know, if somebody asked me what kind of app to develop these days, they don't go anywhere near a game.
Right.
You're either incredibly lucky.
Yeah.
Or you've got millions and millions of dollars in your treasure chest. The App Store is becoming more like the traditional, you know, game platforms, right? You know, you need a lot of money in order to be a part of it. I mean, of course, there's obviously the Doodle Jumps and the, you know, Tiny Wings and the smaller developers who, you know, write an awesome app and it just gains traction. You know, Lauren is. You know, Letterpress has been wildly successful, right? And it can take down Game Center. And, you know, he's a small guy, right? You know, and it's a very innovative app. It's fun.
Yeah, I think it's a great app. I think he also has, it's not a built-in audience, but he knows a lot of people that would love that kind of app. Mm-hmm. And they were evangelical about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, the fact that he priced it free, right, with an in-app purchase, it lets people try it out. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty important thing with a game, you know, because there are no demos, right?
Right.
You can try it out. Now, you can get totally carried away with those in-app purchases, right? People can get addicted to games, right? That's just a natural thing that happens with people. And then you start charging those people money for their addiction. That's the part that I, you know, even though the chalk is always on about hookers and blow, right? That's just not.
Wait, in real life, you're not
right.
Really,
no, sorry.
Huh. Yeah. Okay.
Well, the doorbell's going to ring. Just send them away. Sorry. I totally misunderstood.
Sean can attest that I'm loud at times, but, you know, usually only through, instant messaging.
Good thing we don't have an HR department.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, the you think I get carried away on Twitter, you should see me in iChat.
So yeah, we'll include a transcript.
I don't have to worry about offending anybody in iChat. So.
Oh man. Yeah.